Good evening. Tonight's topic is, can women touch the Torah? So first I want to give a shout out to the scholar I got a lot of this from, which is one Devorah Zlachauer. There's a lot of sources out there, but the challenge here was to arrange them in a logical way so you can see what's going on. Normally what we find in these women's issues is that the original sources permit things, the codes permit, carry them through, and then sometime like 100, 200, 300 years ago, someone comes up with a reason to deny, and then that's what the current practice is. So the little bit of teaser is that's not tonight's story. So let's talk about Tuma. Tuma is ritual impurity. There's really no English word for it. It's uncleanness, impurity. So we'll just say ritual impurity. The opposite of tuma is tahara, which is purity. A person who contracts tuma is tame, if he's a male, and tameya, if she's a female. Now, there are two types of tuma in the Torah. That's a good sentence. So there's ritual impurity and moral impurity. Ritual impurity is known as impurity of the body. It's a physical thing. How do you get that? Touching a corpse, being in a room with a corpse, touching a dead non-kosher animal, giving birth, genital emissions. And that is not an exhaustive list. Moral impurity, the opposite of which is not tahara, purity, it is kedusha, sanctity, is impurity of the soul. This category includes activities that are disgusting or abominable, such as sexual sins like incest, adultery, bestiality, murder and idolatry too. But we're not going to talk at all about that. That's just for completeness. So if you are tameh, how do you get to tahor? In general, purification involves immersion in a mikvah. Sometimes there are additional requirements like waiting until nightfall, waiting 7 days, putting on clean clothes, making a sacrifice. When the purification was complete, the individual was restored to a state of tahara, and we'll talk about what that means in a second. Well, I'll talk about it right now. The two things you can't do when you are in a state of tuma is you cannot go into the temple, not a temple, and you cannot eat sacred foods.
Such as
food that has been set aside for tithes that goes to the temple. Okay, that's the general introduction. Now we're going to look at the sources. So, the first source is from Leviticus, and it's talking about a woman who gives birth. And she shall remain in a state of blood purification for 33 days. That's for a male, 66 for a female. But here's what's important. This is the price of tuma. She shall not touch any consecrated thing, anything that's holy, nor enter the sanctuary until her period of purification is completed. And if you look in the Hebrew, you see the word tahara at the end. So that's purification.
I have a question. What would that mean in terms of her, let's say, preparing food for Shabbat? Would that mean that she couldn't touch the wine? I mean, I know that the wine is not inherently holy, but you are...
No, it's not holy.
So because of that, there's no problem. Or what about making challah and you have to like burn the piece to make...
No, it's all okay.
It's all okay.
This is just food that's put aside, okay, usually for Kohanim, or has been designated as, like if you designate a lamb that's going to the temple,
right,
or wheat, okay, or whatever.
What about a mezuzah?
No. That's okay, but that's... We'll have to go to the end, really, to see that. But that's true. Okay. And now we have... So that's what impurity is for a woman. So how does she get that way? We have another verse now. All these are all from Leviticus. Do not come near a woman during her period of uncleanness. In the Hebrew, Benidat, so she is a nidah, and Tamei Aha, her period of Tamei, to uncover her nakedness. So nidah fits into two halachic categories. First of all, it is a source of tuma, and it makes the menstrual woman Tamei'a, and now she is capable of transmitting tuma to other people by touching them. Second, the second part of the verse, it's really two parts here. So to uncover her nakedness means to have sexual relations with her, and having sex with a nidah is a forbidden relationship in the book of Leviticus, just like sleeping with your aunt or with an animal or all kinds of things. So that's also forbidden activity. So right about now, you're saying, but Steve, what about men? Do they get tuma? And the answer is yes. So let's look at, now we have men verses. So when a man has an emission of semen, which is in Hebrew is shikvat zera, shikvat shachev means to lie with, as in sexual, and zera is seed, the seed of lying, he shall bathe his whole body in water and remain unclean until evening. So first of all, you notice the purification thing, and you notice the time period. He has to wait until evening. Now, this seminal emission is actually a big deal, and we'll talk much about it. The term for a seminal emission is keri, which is from the verb kara and means a happenstance or a frivolity. Those who know Israelis know they say all the time, ma kara, what's happening? A person who is a keri is called a baal keri. Baal just means master of. Like Baal Habayit is the homeowner, for example. So that is the category used throughout the Torah and all the rules. And the emission of semen, whether it occurs by nocturnal emission or by having sex. So a man who has an emission of semen becomes tamei until evening, and he had washed himself in water. His clothes or any skin that came in touch with the semen also becomes impure. And if the emission of semen occurs during intercourse with a woman, then the woman becomes tamei'a because of the semen. And she has the same thing again. She has to go to the mikvah and wait until nightfall to be pure. Now, tuma man is prohibited from the same things as tuma woman. Once again, no entering the temple, no eating of sacred foods. Okay, but wait, there's more. So the next category of men who are tuma is the zav. So when one comes with a discharge, and that is hazav, the zav, comes clean of his discharge, now he's impure, he counts off 7 days this time, he has to wash his clothes, he has to wash his body, and then he is clean again. What is a zav? A zav is a man who has an abnormal genital discharge, probably something like gonorrhea in those days, and he's impure. There is also a female counterpart to the zav called a zava, which is a woman who has some kind of genital discharge that's not her period. So I know this is getting a little technical with all these things, but that's where things stand right now. Now along comes Ezra, and now we're into the Talmud. So Ezra, as you know, after the destruction of the first temple, Jews were exiled, and they came back in 538 BCE, and there were waves of coming back, and Ezra was a leader. And the story goes, this is just the background, that Ezra was renovating the temple, and he found in a secret place a book. And the book was the Torah, which had somehow become lost. Some scholars say it was just the book of Deuteronomy. And he assembled the people, and he read the Torah, and he is considered for that reason on par with Moses as a giver of Torah. So Ezra is heavy mojo. Okay, so Ezra makes 10 enactments, 10 takanas. The following 10 enactments were ordered by Ezra. Oh, let me talk about Takanah first. So a Takanah is a rule that is unrelated to a biblical law and was created by the rabbis for the public welfare. So, for example, reading Torah Mondays and Thursdays is a Takanah. It's not in the Torah. Lighting Hanukkah candles is a Takanah. The word Takanah, the word Takain is the same root as Tikkun Olam, so it means to fix or repair. Okay, so Ezra instituted 10 of these Takanot, and number 10, he decreed that immersion was required for those who had a seminal emission. And the question is asked, is this not in the Torah as it is written? And I gave you the verse up above. Now, here's the new thing. So the Torah said when that happens, you can't do the two cardinal things, eating sacred foods, going into the temple. But Ezra decreed that even the words of Torah, immersion is needed. So this is a new flip on things. That so what is words of Torah? It's basically study and prayer. And that includes saying the Shema, which is a Torah obligation to say twice a day, the Shemona Esrei, and the Birkat Hamazon, the grace after meals. So you recognize this is new, right? He's added something in here that has not existed before. And the question is, why did he do this? Is there something unique for a Baal Keri that calls for this restriction? Or is this just a general concern? So in other words, this is the key question, is Ezra just expanding what Tumah means? Or is he adding restrictions to men who experience these emissions? And we don't know the answer right yet. But everyone understands what the question is here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, so let's remember now that this is what the Baal Keri now has this additional prohibition of Torah. So now we have a Mishnah. A Zav is one who has had a seminal emission, a Baal Keri, a Nida from whom semen escapes, meaning a woman has intercourse and then the semen from the man comes out of her, or who becomes a Nida during the act of intercourse. Three categories. And all of them require a mikvah. Rabbi Yehuda exempts them. So what is the point here? The Mishnah is dealing with three people who are already impure, who then have contact with semen. And does it add to their impurity, is the question.
That's not what I'm reading.
Okay.
I'm reading the three categories of people that require a mikvah, and that Rabbi Yehuda is just saying, no, they don't require a mikvah.
Right.
Rabbi Yehuda exempts them.
And I'll tell you why in a moment.
But there's not the addition. In other words, I see the semen as one of the categories.
The question is, the reason Rabbi Yehuda exempts them is a little technical. It's because every one of these cases, they have to wait 7 days. Whereas if it's just a tumah, you can go to the mikvah and then you're clean.
Okay.
These people, going to the mikvah will not make them pure. So he says, exempts them because it doesn't matter. That's his logic.
Why do they require seven? These are all daily things. They're not 7 days.
No, they are seven. Okay.
The seminal emission, the
Anida is impure for 7 days. Right? That one you agree with?
Becomes Nida during intercourse. Isn't that the that's not the 7 days is when she's got her period.
Right, and that's what her case is, the third case. But the first two come in contact with semen.
Becomes Nida during intercourse.
Right.
That's different than having her.
No, she doesn't
have. I'm sitting here very maturely right now.
She does not have the semen contact, but the first two cases do.
Well, she
what
could.
These three things all have in common is the 7 day period. No pun intended. It's getting a little hard.
Well, no, she could, though, because it says during intercourse.
Right.
So she could have semen
contact. No, but it's just not, it's not counted here. It's counted that she's just a nida.
Okay.
That's how they go. A menstruating woman is impure for 7 days.
Now, that I totally agree with, based on everything I've been taught.
Right.
I just don't see that in this example. I see this as a different example. That they're not talking about the woman who's got her period. They're talking about the woman who became nida through other
ways.
Right.
That's not 7 days. That's we said before that's
the clean and overnight, the evening.
Right, but they don't. They do become, it's 7 days.
Yeah, but aren't they exempt?
They're exempt from going to the mikveh. They're exempt from the 1 day.
Fundamentally, I trust that you're
supposed to. That I copied and pasted that? Well, yes.
But I'm not seeing that in this Mishnah.
Tzavos says seven lishnas. Require a mikveh.
That's all, require a mikveh. And just.
Right, and again, that is the issue, that they're having the one-day mikveh versus the seven-day mikveh. And that's what they're exempted from.
Right. And I don't see those as situations that should have required the 7 days to begin with. To my understanding, the only thing that requires 7 days is a menstrual period.
Yes.
The others are all 1 day, till the evening. These all fall into the category of just till the evening.
The second two require 7 days, but the first one doesn't.
Yeah,
the Zav.
So the Baal Keri, it says here, just does 1 day, but the Zav is 7 days, according to the Torah. So yes, so that's why the Zav in the first issue has to wait 7 days.
And then the other two are Nida.
The second two are Nida.
Okay.
So they're all weak, okay? That makes sense?
Fine. I'm giving in.
Okay.
I still don't see it, but let's move on.
If you don't, I will remove the M&M. Okay, now we have a Tosefta of the Brachot. Zavim and Zavot, men and women, Nidot, and women who give birth, are permitted to read the Torah and to learn Mishnah, Midrash, Halachot, and Agadot. Men who have had a seminal emission are forbidden in all of them. Rabbi Yossi says, he can learn the laws that he is familiar with as long as he does not arrange the Mishnah. Okay, so this Tosefta really expands on the previous Mishnah, and it says the prohibition only applies to the Baal Keri, not to the other categories. Rabbi Yossi says that even Ezra did not decree that a Baal Keri can learn Torah that he's already learned. What he can't do is arranging the Mishnah, and that is a euphemism for looking up the sources of the laws. So he could do what we're doing right now, provided he already had seen these laws before. What's important here also, what they're doing here is that they are actually withdrawing the severity of those rules and saying, you can read Torah, you can do these things while you are a Zav or a Nida. Now, what is interesting, which I'm sure, Michelle, you caught on immediately, is the fact that the Tosefta implies there were women who were already doing all these things, right? They must have been studying Mishnah, Midrash, Agadah in those days, because they are specifically permitted to do so when they are impure. Okay.
Ma'am?
Please.
There's no time frame on women who gave birth.
Yes, there is.
That was the first one.
Yeah.
So a woman...
We didn't... 60 days.
That was only, though, a side note of that, because the rules in the Torah are, woman who gives birth, if the girl has to do 33 days, a boy 33 days, a girl 66 days.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I missed that class.
They,
That's why she came along and said, can she bake challah?
Oh, that's right. Okay.
You were thinking of your phone.
Well, I know I was thinking of other impurities other than giving birth.
Okay, now we go to the Bavli. It has been taught, and you shall make them known to your children and your children's children. Obviously, that's the Torah. And it's followed by the next verse, and this is the book of Deuteronomy. the day on which you did stand before the Lord your God in Horeb. Just as there was dread and fear and trembling and quaking, so too it being Torah study, must be in dread and fear and trembling and quaking. What is he saying in this part one? So he's talking about that people who study Torah should study Torah with a sense of awe and reverence and humbleness and fear and all those things, just like our ancestors did on Mount Sinai. So because of that, from here the sages stated, Zavim, lepers are people who have Tzara'at, which is the mysterious skin disease, which is like a form of Tumah that we don't really know, but we say today it's leprosy, which it's not. And those who engage in intercourse with menstruating women, okay, so these are pretty much the worst of the worst, they are permitted to read Torah, prophets, writings, in other words, to study Tanakh, to study Mishnah and Gemara and Halachot and Agadah. However, those who experience a seminal emission are prohibited. So again, the Baal Keri is prohibited. So this brings us back to the question of, why did Ezra pass this takana? What was his goal? And what this Gemara indicates is that if you're supposed to study Torah with a certain mindset of awe and humility and fear, if you've just had an ejaculation of semen, you're probably not in that mindset. That's where it comes from. So study after engaging in sexual behavior was deemed problematic. And I will also add,
unless it was with a menstruating woman.
I will also add, if it was followed by engagement, it's also a little problematic. But that's what they're getting at. And you'll see a rather graphic description of this when we get to the end. But see, here's what's interesting, right? If Ezra ruled that a Baal Keri, so the sources pretty much say at this point that it doesn't matter what your state of Tumah is, you can study Torah. But if a Baal Keri is not allowed to study Torah, why is the reason? And if the reason is just because nothing of Tumah-ness, but rather it's a state of mind issue, so maybe there's a loophole in there that we can drive through.
You're looking for it.
Yes. So here we have a Yerushalmi to back up that last point, which is Rabbi Chiya Bar Vava said, they only decreed immersion because of Torah study, for if you say to him that he is permitted to study, he will say, I will go and take care of my needs and then learn all I need. Take care of my needs means I will have sex. And then I'll learn. Since you say it is forbidden, no, you can't do that, he comes and learns. So this is backing up the idea that that's what the Takana is all about. Okay, and now we come to the key point. That's for you, Steve.
Yeah, I see the graphic.
Wow.
So this is actually the same text in Brachot that we had right above. It's following paragraph. It has been taught by Rabbi Yehuda ben Batera used to say, Rabbi Yehuda ben Batera used to say, words of Torah are not susceptible to uncleanness. You can't make a Torah tuma. Why? Once a certain disciple was mumbling over against Rabbi Yehuda ben Batera, he said to him, my son, open your mouth and let the words be clear. For words of Torah are not susceptible to uncleanness, as it says. This is from Jeremiah, and I will not sing it for you because it's in an oratorio by Handel. Is not my word like a fire? Just as fire cannot be unclean, so words of Torah cannot be unclean. And then there's a whole bunch of discussion about this and who's right and wrong. And finally, Rav Nachman Bar Yitzhak said, we act in accordance with Rabbi Yehuda ben Batera when it comes to words of Torah. So this is a key point. A Torah cannot be made tuma. And what does that mean? That means there is no existing biblical, Mishnaic, Talmudic source that restricts a woman in Nida from studying Torah, from praying, from entering a synagogue, and touching a Torah scroll. These restrictions were placed on the Baal Keri, and were never applied to a woman in Nidah, and even their application to a Baal Keri was limited. So this is the thing you can take to the bank. Okay. So what other possible reason would there be for a woman not to touch a Torah? Or a man, for that matter. And we have another Tosefta. And there's a whole bunch of things about when it's appropriate to pray. You can't pray in a dirty location. You can't pray when you're in the bathroom. And filthy aloe, you can't say the Shema in a filthy place. And if you did go to such a place, you have to stop, like you're walking down the street saying the Shema, and then you step in dog poop. You have to stop saying the Shema until you are clean once again. This is called tinuf, which just means filth. So this is a possible subcategory of reasons why women shouldn't touch the Torah. That's kind of not related at all to Tuma. But, of course, this applies to men as well as women. And there's nothing to do with Nidah or blood or anything in here. Okay. Now we see that this is really what the story is. And we've seen this in the Tannaitic and Amoraic sources. And we see clearly that a Tosefta permits a woman in Nidah to study Torah. There are no sources substantiating any prohibitions for a woman not to study Torah, a woman in Nidah, to pray, to enter synagogue, to hold the Torah. So where does this come from, right? This is where we usually get the later authorities do some funny business. So now we enter the period of the Rishonim, which is, let's say, 1000 to 1500. These are the primary commentators on the Talmud. And in the period of the Geonim, there are many works, and there was a work called Baraita de Masechet Nidah, which is laws about Tuma and Nidah. And what we're going to see is this is when the idea of halachic Tuma, that the only prohibitions for a Tuma would be entering the temple and eating sacred foods, to now thinking of it as a source of contamination, a source of pollution. And this book will illustrate that. But we'll just go to the source and see it here. So there's a lot of paragraphs in this, but this is just a representative example. And they're talking about a woman who is Nidah. She should not set foot into a house full of holy books or a house set aside for prayer, since she is impure and imparts impurity to the fullest extent. A woman who is in Nidah is forbidden to deal with the separation of challah, the lighting of Shabbat candles. Why? By which she would bring guilt on herself and her household. Now, this is an example. This Masechet is full of prohibitions. You can't be near her spit. You can't greet her. She can't say amen to your prayer. She can't touch her husband's bed. She can't enter the synagogue, etc., etc. So this is kind of ground zero for the anti-camp, if you will. And how did the post-Talmudic authorities read these sharp departures from what came before? So there were three major trends, really two major trends. One trend was to dismiss them. You know, we don't hold by this. And the other was to acknowledge and sometimes support these existing practices. And there are lots and lots of medieval sources of which I have spared you doing those things. But there is a third possibility here. So rather than to ban or to accept, and that is to permit it halakhically, but discourage it in practice. And this is a familiar note, right? And this is kind of a major path that a lot of the Rishonim took. So with that in mind, let's look at the next two sources.
But we don't know where this Baraita, the Masechet Nidah, got it.
It's by one of the Geonim. It's a Geonic work.
Right, so they just, you know, there's no proof text.
No.
Throughout it. They just...
No, and that's, by the way, that's where Baraita comes in, because a Baraita is an authoritative source that's not listed anywhere.
So not listed, but sometimes they can have proof texts within them. The brayters just weren't, the brayter itself wasn't included in the Mishnah, but sometimes brayters could have proof texts.
Only as a support, as an asmachta.
Yeah.
But a brayter has the status of a Mishnah.
Right, but sometimes within them, there
yeah, they'll say, how do we know this?
Right. This, there's no such, there's nothing there. Or at least
I don't, I mean, I have not read this work. Probably will never read this work. So I don't know how they justify these things. The author I have says there was really no substantiation for this.
But yet it was accepted.
Well, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. So let's look at these two sources that knew about it. So the first is not, it's not really Rashi, it's the school of Rashi, and I'm not quite sure what that means. So see, that would be several hundred years after the Baraita. There are women who prevent themselves from entering the synagogue or touching a Torah scroll during their nidah. This is a mere stringency, and they are not required to do this. Thus, so he takes an interesting tack here, where he says, this teaches us that the synagogue is not like the temple. The temple is unique, but in our synagogues, they can do this, they act well, and bless them. So what's interesting is in that very first sentence where he says, women who prevent themselves. So he's saying that there's a custom or a practice of pious women not to do these things, even while he admits they are not required. He says that. This is what I mean by there's a middle path here. Similarly, the Ravya, who we had last time when it came to women's issue, and he says, then the women practice dignity and separation and do not enter the synagogue at the time of their nidah. Once again, it's voluntary. This is a custom they are following.
Self-removal.
Even when they pray, they do not stand before other women. This is another folk practice that the nidah should not block a non-nidah woman. This is what I saw written in the Geonim in the Baraita, which is he's referring to the Baraita, the Masechet Nidah. However, it is not in our Tosefta. In other words, we have no law for this. This custom is appropriate. And again, he says, custom. Custom's okay, but there's no real prohibition.
And this is a self-denial.
Both these two are self-denials.
Yes.
So he's saying this is what pious people do. But again, they all admit that there's no halakha behind what they're saying.
Right.
Okay. So now we, after the period of Rishonim, we get to the period of the codes. And as you're going to see, they all kind of say the same thing. So Maimonides Rambam, you're going to recognize right away from the sources we've looked at already. And once again, the interesting way he combines these things to make his own work. So all who are ritually unclean, even women in their menstruating period, and even a non-Jew, right? Where did that come from? May hold the scroll and read in it, for the words of Torah do not contract uncleanliness, provided the holder's hands are not dirty or soiled. So he's just thrown like three sources in there. So he has a halakha. They must therefore wash their hands and then they can touch it.
Interestingly, he throws the non-Israelite in there.
Right, and that's interesting because this halakha is not aimed at Nidah women. It's aimed at a class of people, and what he's basically advocating here is keep your hands clean. Shulchan Aruch, all who are impure, even a menstruating woman, are permitted to hold a dirty Torah. I read ahead. A Torah scroll and to read from it, provided their hands are not dirty or soiled. So it's just a recapitulation of Maimonides. Now comes the Shulchan Aruch, which is interesting. All those who are impure read from the Torah, and read the Shema, and pray, except for the Baal Keri, who was removed by Ezra from the rest of the impure people. And he prohibited him from reading the Torah, reading the Shema, and from prayer, until they immersed. Why? So the scholars would not be with their wives like roosters. This is a very standard Talmudic thing. Apparently, roosters are extremely promiscuous animals, and when they don't want human beings to act, men to act in that way, they always say, don't be like a rooster. This is something we in the non-farm world no longer get. Okay.
And the afterwards.
But they canceled this enactment, meaning the takana, and returned it to the original law that even a Baal Keri is permitted in Torah, Shema, and prayer without immersion and without washing with 9 kavs of water. Such is the custom. So the takana is explicitly canceled. And now our women, now again, do not have the practice of refraining from entering the synagogue.
Negative there.
And Rabbeinu Yerucham wrote that he saw men and women err and say that a woman who has given birth needs be careful not to enter the synagogue until 40 days for a son, 80 days for a daughter had passed. And then this is pretty raw. This custom is in error, and one needs to stop them. So not only is it okay, you can't not do it, to use a double negative. Now, of course, always remember that, let's go to the Rima. So that is the Ashkenazic gloss on the Shulchan Aruch. There are those who wrote that a Nida on the days when she sees blood may not enter a synagogue or pray or mention God's name or touch the Torah. And there are those who say she is permitted to do all of those. And that is the correct opinion. Again, now the qualification. But the custom in these lands is according to the first claim. And in these lands is in Ashkenazic Europe as opposed to the Sephardi world. And in the days after menstruation, before immersion, the custom was to permit, even in the places where they were stringent, in the high holidays and similar occasions when many assemble and go to synagogue, them to go to synagogue like all other women, because, and this just sounds like my wife, it causes them great sadness that everyone is assembled and they stay outside. So he's being very nice there. He does fudge a little with the customs in these lands. And all of the following authorities after this, we'll read the Mishnah Torah one more time. All who are ritually unclean are bound nevertheless to read the Shema. Ezra and his colleagues ordained that only one who had an emission, an exception to all, may not read the words of Torah till he has bathed. This ordinance was not adopted universally. And then why? This is great. The majority of the community was unable to observe it, and it fell into desuetude. Which, you know, this is really just saying, well, like, men didn't want to do this, so it was embarrassing to them, so we stopped. All the Israelites accordingly have a custom to read the Torah and recite the Shema, even if they've had emissions. And I had heard once upon a time, and I don't know if I can support this in any way, but in the old days when you had to go to the mikveh, you had a staircase going one way into the temple and another staircase going down to the mikveh. And the people who were Baal Keris had to go on the other side. And of course, they were all men. And it was considered embarrassing because everyone knew what you had done if they saw you on the Baal Keri side. So that's why they stopped doing it. Or there was another question where you'd come into class and someone would, you know, Shlomo would say, I have to exempt myself today. And then everyone would know and it would be embarrassing to him. Okay. All the later authorities refer to this practice as a custom, not a law, and significantly contrast them with the clear halachic permissibility of those who are impure, including women in Nidah, to touch a Torah scroll, to study, or to pray. And finally, the last piece I found is actually right up to date. I don't know if it's this year or in the last few years, but this guy is still alive. He's a very Orthodox rabbi in Male Adumim. In my humble opinion, it would seem that if the community wishes to please its women on Simchat Torah, and accordingly they declare that in the women's gallery, one of the important women will hold the Torah scroll while others dance around her in an honorable and refined manner. Clearly, this is a positive development, a constructive step with no prohibition at all, for it was never forbidden for women to hold the Torah. And perhaps even the men might learn from them how to behave with appropriate respect. However, all this is on condition there is agreement among the community and agreement with the rabbi of the community. So that's very interesting because here's where we have the difference, I said, from everything that comes before us, which is, there is absolutely no reason why women cannot do all of these things all of the time, and anyone that tells you it is halakhically prohibited is wrong. And you can get a little fudge if you go to a shul X and they say, this is not our custom. It's not according to our lore.
Yes.
Then
but you could get
away with it, but you could challenge it.
But you are supposed to adopt the minhag of the local community when you go into another community.
Yes.
You're supposed to respect their minhag. So,
yes.
So if they're saying this is our minhag, you are supposed to respect
it. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Even though halakhically it's not correct, you as the guest are expected to
right.
respect their minhag.
But one would hope you could go to the rabbi and say, you know this is not forbidden, and they might adjust their practices accordingly.
They might. But then again, they might not.